Today's program was brought to you by 100 Bogart Street, the brand new co-working space in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Learn more at 100bogart.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Ooh, I like the way you do. Whoa, the way you took it so slow.
Hey, hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kathy Irway, and it is a gray, gloomy, miserable Sunday in January today. And that is to say, it is the perfect day for one type of food, which is noodle soup. Although I think my guest today would disagree. He would probably say that any day is a good day for noodle soup. That is because he just wrote a book called Noodle Soup, Recipes, Techniques, and Obsession, with over 100 recipes. And I have to say, this is not your fluffy coffee table cookbook. This is a serious scholarly ode to noodle soup in all its historical iterations and modern day adaptations throughout the world. And it is written by the professor of history and food studies at University of Pacific. He's also the author of two other food history books. And it is my personal noodle soup muse, Ken Albala. How are you?
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us and congrats on this book. It is such an amazing book. And I gotta wonder though, what noodle soup did you make so far today?
You know, I didn't.
Okay. I know it's here.
I'm planning on making one tonight. I bought a few pounds of cherry stone clams, and I was thinking, you know how nicely clams go with linguine or like on a white clam pizza, if you know New Haven? Mm-hmm. I thought that would make an interesting soup with some clam juice and cream and, you know, shell the clams and then put some fresh noodles in it. So that's what I'm going to do tonight.
That is a great idea. So you're over in the West Coast, so I don't blame you for not having made one already. But so this book is your latest, and it really dives into the history, which I can't wait to talk a little bit more about with regards to noodle soup. But just to get started, why and when did you get obsessed with noodle soup?
Well, it was actually a mistake. I never sat down and said, I'm going to write a book on noodle soup and plan that. I was actually teaching a class at Boston University, and they gave me a really nice apartment, and it had no utensils at all. No, not even a pot, not a fork.
Oh,
and so
stinks.
I just happened to walk down the street right on Commonwealth Avenue and bought a little pot and some ramen, like instant ramen out of a package. And I don't know why. I've never tasted it before. I mean, I must have tasted it. It wasn't a thing I ate regularly, and it was really nice for breakfast. So I, sort of bought some extra vegetables and then, threw some shrimp in and whatever, and I just sort of got hooked on eating that for breakfast and maybe was doing it a month or so and thought, you know, I can make the noodles by hand and I can use fresh, I can make the stock and I can do all this stuff. And without realizing it, I'd already begun to collect recipes, and maybe, I think I did it for about two and a half years.
Wow.
And then just the book wrote itself, you know, it was simple after that.
That is quite a story. The best accidents, you know, happen in the kitchen, I think.
Absolutely.
Inspirations. So most people think of noodle soup as more of an East Asian food tradition, but you cover the globe. There's Slovakian pulled noodles, and you've traced the history of noodle soup and to try to pinpoint its exact origins, which are not exactly something you can pinpoint, it seems.
No, the oldest noodle soup is found in China, which dates back about 4,000 years, but it's made of millet. Mm-hmm. So there are really, really old Asian soups with noodles. There's also a lot of Middle Eastern ones, things that are like noodles. Sometimes they're fried, but I think wherever you have wheat, basically, you're going to have people figure out that you can grind it, add water, and then dump it into a soup. So I do cover most places that have soups, but there surprisingly are places that don't have them, or there are not many forms. India, surprisingly, which has wheat from a very early time, there aren't many noodle soups there. And my guess, and I was just having this discussion with a colleague, my guess is that where places where you eat with your hands, noodle soup just becomes impossible. Because you'd have to stick your hand into the hot soup or sip it or try and, slurp the noodles out. It would just be impossible. So I think the solution, for Asia, obviously, was to use chopsticks. Mm-hmm. And in the West, it was a fork, or spoon, using two utensils.
Right.
And the other interesting thing is where you do have those utensils, like in Italy, for example, you almost never have long strands of noodles in a soup. It's
right.
usually very short ones that you can pick up with a spoon. Like Italian noodle soups usually have macaroni in them. Even German ones, when you have spätzle in a soup, it's something you can eat with a fork.
Mm-hmm.
But usually not long strands.
So what came first, the chopsticks or the noodles?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. chopsticks are about Han Dynasty China, so I don't think there's much evidence long before that. So noodles are older then.
Wow. So let's talk for a minute about noodle eating skills and etiquette. eating skills is actually a funny idea for a class. I hope you teach someday skills and strategies.
That would be great.
For
that would really be great. Well, slurping, of course. In Asia, it's considered polite, but I think there's a logic to it. You actually are aerating the noodles and soup and cooling them down just a little bit, but you're also sending the aromas up into the back of your olfactory organs above your palate. So it tastes better when you slurp. I mean, it's true of wine, obviously. When you swirl the wine around and aerate it and then slurp, you're bringing it into your whole head. And I think exactly the same thing is the case with noodles. And it was actually very funny. I was in Japan a few months ago on a Japanese TV program, which was totally bizarre, learning how to make katsuobushi, which incidentally, there's a recipe in the cookbook for making it. I didn't know how to do it when I wrote that recipe. I do now. It's a lot more complicated, and I've made some strange mistakes. But the funny thing is that like they filmed me eating noodles often, and they were like amazed that I was actually
slurping
it. Like Japanese people were like, he's doing that. No one told him to do that. It was very amusing.
Is there anything to keep in mind while you're slurping to get the best
effect? Yes, don't slurp too hard because you can inhale them.
They
will literally go right down your lungs, and I've done that a couple of times. So slurp gently.
Okay. And splatter? Can you minimize splatter? Is there any way? Because I have that problem.
It is really hard, and I have to say, when I started the whole project, I had facial hair, I had a beard, goatee. It's the dumbest thing on it. You just cannot eat noodle soup without getting it in your beard. So I shaved, and I still don't have facial hair as a result of that.
How about the ideal amount to grab? I was actually cracking up reading the part where you describe the one approach, which is to grab a huge tangle of noodles, sort of hold it above your head and tilt your head and try to shove it into your mouth.
Well, you've seen people do that.
What's
right?
wrong I with
mean,
that? Yeah.
I guess many people think you've got to eat the noodle soup very quickly, and I understand that, because if it gets cold, it's just of no interest, and you really want it to be hot. And I've seen people, if you have chopsticks, you can grab a huge wad and shove them in your mouth, and I think you're not tasting it then, you're just inhaling it quickly.
Right.
So I would say grab a few strands and enough that you can slurp without it filling your whole mouth.
And you want to feel the texture and enjoy that
exactly,
the texture of the noodles.
Yeah, and I think especially when you have slippery noodles, half the fun is actually feeling that slight sliminess in your mouth. I mean, that's a really interesting texture. I don't think Americans in general appreciate slimy things, but I like that.
Mm-hmm. So we talked a little bit about some of the first noodles that were discovered in an archaeological dig in China, which were made of millet. You mentioned, which is wild. What about some of the first earliest noodle soup evidence in the Western world?
Well, again, there's not archaeological evidence. Noodles usually disappear because they're made of wheat or some other material. The one in China just happened to have been in a bowl that was overturned and then covered in rubble in an earthquake or something like that. So, and they disappeared. The moment that they took them out, they disintegrated
after they took
a couple of pictures.
Right,
but there really aren't comparable noodles in the West, like you might think maybe Pompeii, you know, where there's bread that incinerated and is still in its same form. In Italy, for example, you really don't have noodles until the Middle Ages. And then, you know, they're mentioned in texts and, you know, the story that was really made up at one point, that Marco Polo went to China and brought back noodles. It's completely fabricated.
Really?
He says something to the effect of, oh, look, they have pasta just like ours.
Okay.
And there's, you know, records of noodles in Italy long before Marco Polo. But I think that the connection would be with the Arabs in Sicily. I think that's probably where it came from. And then was, you know, the trade links from Sicily to Genoa, and most of the early noodle recipes in the Middle Ages in Italy refer to Tria Januensis or Trilli or Tria, something like that, which comes from the Arab word Itria, which comes from the Greek word Itria, which goes all the way back. So there's a fairly straight line linguistically. You know, there's no actual physical evidence. There's a couple of recipes here and there, but linguistically, I think that's where it points to. So the ancients had something like noodles, I think. You know, you could say even the ancient Roman tracta, although it's baked, it's more like a cracker.
Okay.
But, you know, that thing, after it goes in layers into a lagani, which, sort of, you know, the word lasagna comes right from that.
I was wondering about that.
Very, very similar to lasagna.
So you have this quote from the poet Horace, who says something in Latin, but you translate it as, I'm going home to my pot of leeks, chickpeas, and noodles. So,
it's not absolutely certain that that's a noodle that we would recognize as, you know, like raw dough thrown into boiling water. But I think, you know, if you had a big pot of soup and you took this long, you know, the square cracker-like things and put them into the soup, it's almost a noodle. It's, like, so close.
Mm-hmm.
And Horace, you know, of course, was trying to show the simplicity of the dish, and he didn't want fancy nonsense at some, you know, banquet. He wanted absolute rustic, homey simplicity.
Right.
You find that in a lot of authors in ancient Rome, Juvenal especially.
I love this other poet. You have some quotes through literature of noodle soup. So there's this poet in China who wrote an ode, or he described a chef in action, the poet Hong Junju. He said, he kneaded the dough to the right consistency. Then he would drop it into the water in long strings, white like autumn silk.
Yeah, isn't that lovely?
That's really great. All right, so we're going to talk. You have so many different noodle recipes and soup recipes throughout this book from around the world that I want to get to. And I really want to learn more about how to make noodles.
Sure.
We're going to cut to a quick little commercial break and we'll be right back.
Bogart Street is finally open and ready for Bushwick. Bogart is a brand new, state-of-the-art co-working space that provides turnkey workspaces, including open layout desks, meeting spaces, and furnished private offices. Members have access to top-notch amenities such as custom furniture, high-speed internet, spacious kitchenettes with coffee and tea, printers, scanners, and much more. Alongside their professional work environment, 100 Bogart also provides exclusive educational programming for any curious entrepreneur. Heritage Radio Network has made their new office home at 100 Bogart and will host many events there in the future. For more information about their co-working space, visit 100bogart.com and become a member to network, create, and educate.
All right, we're back chatting more with Ken Albala. He's the author of his latest cookbook, Noodle Soup Recipes, Techniques, and Obsession. And we're also joined in the studio with Greg Bresnitz, host of Snacky Tunes here on Heritage.
Hi.
And he's just hungry listening in. So we're going to talk a lot about these recipes that you have. I didn't realize that so many cultures, I know you mentioned there's some that do not have noodle soup, but for instance, the Netherlands has a Groten Soppe met Ballade.
That's close. Ballet, yes. Yeah, it just means little balls in Dutch.
And it looks like a noodle soup from the picture.
That is exactly what it is, yeah.
Yes, and then there's the Slovakian noodle soup. you have some fun, like, absurdities too throughout this book.
Yeah, I mean, I got to a point where I thought, you know, if something exists on Earth, I can probably make a noodle out of it. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that's true. It's a strange procedure. I think, you know, when people put vegetables and things into noodles, they usually cook the like you'd spinach. You'd cook the spinach first and squeeze out the water and then add it to the noodle. But there's really no way to get really, really intense spinach flavor. Because you know, there's so much water in it still that you would have to add a ton of flour to make a noodle out of it. So what I decided to do was to dehydrate vegetables in shave them very thin, or if they're leaves, just dehydrate them, put them in a coffee grinder, and then add them in equal parts to flour, and then just add egg to bind it. So you really are getting this intense, intense vegetable, or adding squash, or adding carrots, or anything. And the colors turn out wonderful. And in fact, I did a whole salad. I took 6 salad ingredients, lettuce, tomatoes, carrots, cucumber, some other things, and dehydrated each separately, ground them, made them into doughs, and then made a whole salad out of it, made noodles, but with the exact same ingredients as a salad, and it looked just and tasted fantastic.
Now, what is your take, though, on spiralizing zucchini into, and I hate this word, well, I don't even want to say it, but zoodles.
I mean, there's nothing inherently wrong with doing that, and we actually have a spiralizer in my household. I don't use it very often, but it's there. I just object to you calling it a noodle.
Greg, you're shaking your head.
You have a noodle, use some starch of some kind, and it should have the texture and flavor of a noodle, you know?
It seems to just, you know, knock down
It's something else.
Yeah, I mean, we have words for a reason, right? So, it's
right,
vegetable.
Exactly.
What is in a name? But the noodle is in a name.
But the cool thing, Ken, here is that you explore that there are vegetables, like you were saying, that you turn into noodles, not just by shape, though. Forging the spinach into the noodle with the dough and so forth.
Right, and you know, the one that really eluded me for many years was artichokes, and I always thought, you know, I'll just add cooked artichoke to flour, or I will, scrape the leaves and somehow get that into a noodle, and they were never that good. They just didn't taste right. And it turns out that if you take baby artichokes and you shave them very thin, dehydrate them, ground them, add them, again, equal part to flour, you get this intense, intense artichoke flavor. That's really one of my favorites. That turned out fabulous. I think the fava beans also are very easy to do. And if you don't have a dehydrator, you can always just put the thing in the oven, a very low oven, and leave it overnight, and it'll dry out fine.
Does it help if the vegetable has more starches to it? So
it doesn't
fava
matter.
Beans?
No, not at all. In fact, I've used weeds from the backyard. Just looking through the book and noticed, hey, that's the side of my house where there's weeds growing. But I ate them. I've used pretty much anything. I've used crickets. That was really the only noodle that was terrible. I would not recommend doing that.
That sounds like a good way to eat crickets, though.
But you know when you walk into a pet store and you have this musty, weird smell? That's the crickets. It's awful.
Ooh, I see what you mean. Yeah, but if you can hide that in a noodle soup, I think I would give that a try.
Yeah, it wasn't good.
That was
the only one that was really disastrous. If you use cricket flour in sweets and with chocolate and things, you don't notice it. But in a noodle, it was really intense.
Now, flour is not the only starch that you need for noodles. You have, you have purple yam here. There's, mung bean noodles, the glass noodles.
I mean, you could really make a noodle out of any starch. So if you go into an Asian grocery store and buy tapioca or mung bean or potato starch or anything, even wheat starch, you basically make a kind of steamed noodle with that. So you would either put it in a tray and a steamer. And I don't know why people don't make these at home. They're really, really easy to do. And you steam it and then you cut it up. Or you can cook the starch with water in a pan until it becomes a dough, and then extrude it. Like use your ricer or use a small hand extruder. They're very easy to find, and just extrude it right into the boiling water, and you get a kind of rice starch noodle, which is for pho or for anything. But what's really interesting, and something that I found, figured out after writing this book, of course that always happens, you know, you're still doing it, and then you realize, oh my gosh, I found this technique. But if you take flour and you knead it a lot, you'll build up the gluten strands in it, and then you put it into a bowl of water and continue kneading. What happens is the starch will seep out of it and sink to the bottom of the bowl, and you get these lumps of sort of gummy gluten. I'm forgetting the name of it in Chinese. You have these lumps of wheat gluten, and you fry those, and they're really lovely, chewy, and the texture is very much like chicken. It's really weird. And then you pour off the water, and you've got that starch, so you can actually make a noodle.
I've done that.
From flour with, you know, the starch and the liang pi, I think is what it's called.
Okay. But you can have, like, totally gluten-free noodles, too, because I see you have, like, all these ancient grains. You got chestnut flour. You got...
Yeah.
And they have a history, too. It's not like you're just kind of goofing around here.
Well, both, actually. chestnuts, acorns make a really, really lovely flour. You can make a noodle out of it, 100% acorn. Anything that's got, like starch and carbohydrates in it will you can make into a noodle. Beans make really nice noodles also.
Mm-hmm.
But I also, you know, was playing around with things that you don't traditionally use in noodles. But you know one I should mention that's really interesting, and mm-hmm. I don't think many people realize you can make it at home, is called shirataki, which is a noodle made out of a tuber that has not only no gluten, but it has no calories either. Your body can't process it. So it just goes right through you, basically.
And you can make that yourself?
You can make it at home, uh-huh. Yeah. You buy this stuff called konjac flour, or sometimes it's called glucomannan, and it's a very strange sort of alchemical procedure that I outline pretty in detail here, unlike many of the other recipes, which are quick and easy. This one's sort of weird, but it makes a very beautiful translucent noodle with no flavor whatsoever. That's the only reason I'm not crazy about them.
Right.
But no calories either.
Well, that's, you know, good for those post-holiday diets right now.
Exactly right.
No flavor, no calories.
No flavor, trade-off. Yeah. No calories. Sounds good to me. But, okay, so you mentioned a little bit about the balance of getting these sort of traditional recipes and then also goofing around and creating your own. What's your take on, you know, finding authenticity within food and recipes?
Oh, that's a really hard question.
You mentioned it's a conundrum
these
days.
I think the problem is, of course, authenticity is a moving target. You know, mm-hmm. What are you talking about? Are you speaking about a very specific time, a particular person, or kitchen, or are you talking about the way people do it back in the home country, or you know, something like that? I'm not pretending to be authentic in anything. You know,
mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people will, you know, that's what they want. And if you want that, then find someone who comes from that culture and will give you exactly the way they do it. My approach is really that you should go into the kitchen, have fun, play around, and experiment. And if you end up adding an ingredient that is not traditional, so what? If it tastes mm-hmm. good, use it. And, you know, I addressed this question specifically when in the pho recipe, because if you'll remember, there was a little bit of a scandal about a guy who was not of Vietnamese extraction telling everyone how to eat their... This is how you need
this
to eat
like
your noodle
soup. This is like the end-all-be-all of how to make pho.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Vietnamese people got very upset. Who the hell are you to tell us how to... We've been doing this a long time. So I was very careful to say, you know, this is not authentic. I'm not telling you this is the way anyone does it or this is the way you should do it. This is the way I do it. And, you know, give it a shot. If it tastes good, then fine. You know, enjoy it. So I'm not making any pretense to authenticity. And I think that's even the case when I was writing recipes that are based on my own my grandparents and my background. I said, you know, I don't have any authority over this because of my bloodline. You know, I don't know any more about it than anyone. I had to learn.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you know, when you can speak with authority, I think really comes from experience or from education. You know, if you're learning about something and you've tasted it and, you know, then I think
and
you can say, here's what it is. You know, I thought mm-hmm. about this also with ramen. You know, I went to Japan, ate it in a yatai in Fukuoka, and I thought, you know, that doesn't give me any authority to write the recipe just because I was there and tasted mm-hmm. it, so what?
But I feel like there's another level when you kind of have this vast, amount of information about noodle soup from around the world where you can see everything more in context to this category of food rather than like trying to dictate exactly how to make one type that is very traditional to one culture. That's very tricky. I think that's where a lot of like, you know, emotions get involved.
Yeah, and I totally understand it. And I understand cultural appropriation, and I, you know, certainly, but, you know, I can see both sides of it. But I think the safer thing to do is just say, here's a recipe. Make no claims about it. Mm-hmm. And just enjoy it if you want it.
Now, what was hardest to pick up? Was it you have like a lot of techniques for how to hand pull noodles and so forth.
Yeah, that's a really hard one. I mean, I would say to this, I've done it a few times where I thought this is okay. It's an okay noodle, you know, a proper pulled lamian, where you stretch the dough and you swing it around and twist it and then pull it again. And, you know, I've seen people who are expert at this, and I swear, it's got to take a lifetime. It is really, really difficult. So what I decided to do is not try and get people to do that, but actually make a simpler pulled noodle, one that I do all the time. It just takes time. You have to spend about a half an hour kneading it.
Mm-hmm.
And contrary to the way you normally would add flour to a noodle to prevent it from sticking to the board, here you add water. You keep adding more water and actually try and get as much water into it as possible. And you've got a really soft, sticky dough. You let it rest for 6 hours. Sometimes I cut it first and then let it rest, and I oil it just so it doesn't stick together. And it's so easy to pull. It's just absolutely simple. In fact, I'm doing a talk in San Francisco next month, and I made a challenge that I would pull a noodle around the entire block to see if I could do that. I might need people to hold it up so it doesn't go on the floor. But
wow,
we'll see if that
a group
happens,
pull.
What about the micron bowl, the smallest noodle?
Yes.
Oh gosh,
that seems impossible.
That was, just on a whim, I thought, let me see if I can make the smallest noodle possible. So I actually threw that bowl. I'm not sure it's clear in the book that all the pottery in there I made also. And I took all the pictures, you know, figured out how to do photography, basically, in the course
of
the book.
Yeah, so this bowl is like on your finger.
That's the tiniest bowl that fit into my, right on my fingertip. And the noodles themselves, you know, I just got out a magnifying glass and basically used maybe a thimble full of noodle, you know, of dough to make the noodles. I also thought, let me see if I can make the largest noodle on earth. And I thought of, you know, putting the dough on the driveway, rolling
what?
It out and hose and, you know, pouring hot water over it to make it. And I thought, this has gotten to be a little absurd. So I stopped there.
Okay, yeah, because how do you then cook it? Because it's not a noodle until it's cooked, right?
That's right. Yeah. I was thinking a bathtub full of hot water.
Okay.
You know, like scalding hot water and then filling the whole bathtub. And I still think I want to do this as a publicity stunt. Get someone to actually go in a bathtub filled with noodles. I think that would be really fun. Like, you know, a proper soup and then, you know, have humans.
What about like a fringe? I can see noodles being like a nice fringe for a gown or something like that. That could work.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I can't wait. So this book just came out and it looks like you're going to have fun with it. Any upcoming events people can check out? Maybe the longest hand pull event?
Yeah, well, this will be at Omnivore Books. I think it is the 29th of February, if you're in San Francisco. Oh, no, sorry, March 1st.
Okay, so you might see a noodle pulled around the block of Omnivore's bookstore. I can't wait. all right, so I guess we're about out of time here. But Ken, one last thing. What is your favorite absolute right now of the moment noodle soup that maybe we don't know about and we should try?
Oh, gosh. I think if you make a stock of crabs, like the crab shells and shrimp shells, save them up for a long time and make a really intense shellfish stock and put a rice noodle in it with a little lemon and a ton of cilantro, a hit of sriracha, that is just heaven.
That sounds so good. Really good. Rice noodles. And so for that light flavor, you can taste all the crabby. Nice.
Yep, and crab meat, of course, you know, or whole shrimp. Or you chop up the raw shrimp really finely and make little balls out of them, held together with a little starch, and just drop them into the soup. That is so good.
That sounds like a good one. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing, hopefully, your clam noodles later on.
Oh, yeah, well, I'll post it tonight.
This evening on Instagram. So definitely check out, can people follow you on Twitter and
sure.
Instagram?
Yes, I'm on Twitter, I'm on Instagram. Most everything I post is on Facebook, though.
All right. Well, thanks so much again, Ken. I can't wait to see what fun you have in the aftermath of this book and maybe a sequel. So
okay. Well, thanks so much for having me. This was a ball.
All right. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks for having me, Kathy.
All right. Thanks, everyone at Heritage. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
I like the way you do. Whoa, the way you took it so slow.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Heritage_Radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.